The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I work here in author events, and it is my pleasure to introduce Michelangelo Signorelli. Michelangelo Signorelli is famous for his gutsy and outspoken gay rights advocacy. His seminal 1993 manifesto, Queer in America, examined the political forces responsible for the LGBT closet. He is also the author of three other books, Life Outside, Outing Yourself, and Hitting Hard, and has written articles for dozens of publications, including the New York Times, Salon, and the LA Times. A 2011 inductee into the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association Hall of Fame, he was also one of Out Magazine's Out 100 for the year 2012. A founding editor at Outweek and a columnist and editor at large for The Advocate, Signorelli is currently an editor of the Gay Voices section of the Huffington Post. He also, as many of you probably know, hosts a daily talk show on Sirius XM Radio. His new book argues that while some Americans think the struggle for gay rights has been won, there continue to be hidden and insidious obstacles in the path toward true equality. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you please join me in welcoming Michelangelo Signorelli.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out tonight. I have been on a tour around the country and talking to people and getting their ideas. And so I'm really happy to open up a discussion to you after I speak a little bit about the book and what made me write this book, and then some of the things that I found in researching it and hit on. I started to see several years ago that, you know, as we would be making these victories and celebrating wins, we would sometimes see a disconnect between the facts on the ground in the LGBT community and some of these wins. And when the wins were modest, you know, I really was thinking about this from back in 2009, that disconnect wasn't so great. But as we saw in the last few years, we've had extraordinary wins, and it's been enormous. It's been incredible. And it's a great thing. And we may have a huge win in June with the Supreme Court. And these are certainly things to be celebrated and certainly things for us to pat ourselves on the back and energize people around and talk about how we got there, because so much of it is from the hard work and activism of so many people who've really fought, I think, from the grassroots on up on so many of these issues. These last few years have really been extraordinary, and I started to see that disconnect between the wins and the celebrations and the facts on the ground, and it started to really trouble me, because even as we had these great wins, bigotry and homophobia and transphobia was continuing all across the country, and stories would erupt of people who would face discrimination and violence and be thrown out of their jobs and out of their homes. And I would feel as if these stories wouldn't get a lot of attention, and often it would fall upon the people who were less fortunate in the community, the people who had less resources in the community, and weren't able to get that message out. And what I started to notice was the celebrations and the wins would be so kind of uplifting for people that I think they just kind of put all of these other issues out of mind. And I think if this happens to any movement, I think particularly for the LGBT movement, a couple of things played into it. One is that we've been so despised and so hated for so long, for, you know, eons, and then we finally find our voice And then only to be decimated by a horrific epidemic and see complete indifference in response to it. And then we have these winds, and I think that they become spellbinding and intoxicating and, you know, kind of become a psychological salve for people in terms of looking at that. That bigotry is still out there. And I started to see the word inevitable being used a lot. Well, now it's inevitable that we will win everything. And nothing is inevitable. You have to keep working. And that sort of is the apathy that we see probably happen in many movements. But what I also started to see was that there was kind of a change in strategy beyond the apathy and complacency, a sort of idea that now that we were winning and our opponents were losing, we should reach out to them and be magnanimous and be gracious and feel sorry for these poor people who are losing now. And I think that really is sort of a trap because our enemies are very, very astute. They know exactly what's going on. They're organizing, and they are not going down. And they have created a backlash against every other movement, and there's no reason why they won't do it with us and have us in perpetual battles for a very long time. So I started seeing that play out, and it troubled me, and that's what got me writing the book, and I talk about victory blindness in that first chapter of the book, looking at how, you know, dangerous this was, that people were kind of focused on the victories, not focused on what actually was happening out there. And I guess I was very clued into what was happening, or couldn't, you know, and I do want to say, this isn't about any certain kind of person, or I think we all succumb to victory blindness, and I think we all do it at different times, and so I'm not saying I'm not somebody who can succumb to it, or that it's about any group of people, but I'm kind of forced to deal with all of this in the work that I do, and particularly on my radio program. Whenever we would see a story in the media where somebody was thrown out of a restaurant, you know, gay couple thrown out of a shop, or a transgender woman told, we don't, you know, serve people like you at the spa. Whenever we would talk about these stories, the phones would light up with people with just enormous, you know, amounts of stories of their own, all across the country, rural areas, cities, elsewhere, places where people had protections, places where people don't. Some of the stories were hideous and you know, terrible. People told to leave a restaurant, leave a shop, people fired from their jobs. And, of course, the reality is that this is happening and has been happening all across the country. And marriage equality is great, but as you all know, living in a state with marriage equality, if you have marriage equality and you don't have rights when you get married, you could be fired from your job. You know, 85% of the counties in Oklahoma, no one has gotten married who's gay or lesbian because they're afraid of what would happen if they actually did. And so I started to really, as I was working on the book, really started to research and put together a lot of these stories from across the country, and looking at, as well, the other kinds of bigotry that not only continue, but in perhaps even are exacerbated by our wins, because the visibility creates a backlash, the visibility creates a fear, it sort of activates a fear in many people who are still very homophobic and very transphobic. In New York, in Seattle, in other cities, we saw a rise in gay bashing, commensurate with the wins on equality. And we also saw a rise in 2011, and sort of from 2011 to 2013, this rise in anti-gay murders across the country, and a rise in anti-LGBT violence, but also a rise in New York in 2011 was a year when we saw a 40% increase in homeless LGBT youth in this year that we got marriage equality. Now, what was happening? Well, were people just feeling, okay, I can come out now and tell my parents, and those parents weren't accepting? Perhaps. Is it because there's more visibility on these issues? It's certainly hard to know, but I gathered all of that information as well for this book, kind of gathering a lot of the ways that the visibility was actually kind of being responded to with the bigotry. All of these stories we've seen, brides told they can't get a wedding dress here, a florist, a baker, all of this sort of is a response to our wins and our marriage equality. I'm sure before people who were gay were buying cakes from these bakers and for gay events of all kinds, and nobody seemed to care. But now all of a sudden it is a big issue. And we also see, you know, sort of this visceral reaction to our intimacy and expressing our intimacy. People thrown out of taxi cabs, people thrown out of restaurants again because they might have been touching and kissing. And, you know, I was walking on the street in Chelsea, the gayest neighborhood in the world, and kissed my husband briefly as we passed each other, and some man passed by and called us disgusting. And of course, that's nothing compared to what's happening to so many people across the country who experience far worse. And I really got to looking even further at where things were and finding that, and there's a lot of research in the book pointing to interesting data sets pointing to how deeply closeted people still are all across the country. And in particular parts of the country, very deeply closeted, upward of 80% of gay men in Mississippi, using this really interesting research that a Google data scientist used, looking at Facebook and Match.com and Craigslist and Google searches for women asking, how do I know if my husband is gay, and all kinds of interesting stuff. But that is pretty just shocking, you know, 80% of gay men in Mississippi are in the closet, and nationally, a little over 50%. It shows how far we need to go, and there's no reason to believe it's any different with lesbians or bisexual people as well. It was, again, just more information that was showing me how deeply entrenched homophobia was. And then I did some research on how much, you know, things have really changed in terms of heterosexuals and how they perceive LGBT people. And some fascinating research in this book showing that as we've seen all these polls shift dramatically, and every day there's a poll, there's another poll today, right? As we see all these polls shift dramatically, when researchers do implicit bias studies, not explicit, of course the polls are a measure of the explicit, what people will say to a pollster, what they find is that the change in implicit bias has been very slight against LGBT people. Now, it's, I guess, progress that people will be less likely to say to a pollster that they don't like us, but the fact that they still harbor it means it's kind of more dangerous in a way, and it is harder to confront, you know. Not that we would ever want to wish Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church back, but you know what you're getting when you see those people. When you have this implicit bias, it becomes much more difficult to take on. And I started to look beyond just the issues like, you know, protections and you know, bias and the closet and, you know, where we aren't protected, the 29 states and federally. I mean, that's kind of the obvious thing I think that everybody knows that, you know, even with marriage equality, we still need. But I started to look at just our culture in general and asking, are we really satisfied with how we're portrayed in the media and in popular culture? Where we're often sanitized and we are made palatable to heterosexuals. And we allow it to go on. We're sort of, again, perhaps so intoxicated with just the idea that there's representation out there that we don't question that it's very sanitized, it's very white, it's very male, but it's also sexless and harmless and sort of doesn't challenge that deep-seated homophobia, that very implicit bias that I was talking about, that if we're really going to move forward, we really need to challenge. And so I started asking those questions, and I was drawn to the book Covering by Kenji Yoshino, of New York University, a law professor, and kind of took his book from 2006, which really made a very, you know, amazing impact on how all minority groups, all marginalized groups, women as well, kind of that when they attain a certain level of status, attain certain rights, but still face bigotry, they think the strategy is to cover, to try to fit in, blend in, be team players, don't focus on the difference, be palatable. And it hasn't worked for other groups. And he makes the case that it's certainly not going to work for LGBT people. And I think the book was very ahead of its time in 2006. So I really, and he said in that book, I want to take the word covering. I want somebody to take the word covering and make it as popular as the closet. So I try to do that in this book, because I took covering and I applied it to everything. What we all do in our own lives, but what we see on TV, what we see in the media, sanitized, palatable kind of images. And then I looked at the media as well, and why we, again, are satisfied with the idea that they're talking about it and talking about our rights, but we're not questioning how they're really talking about it. Again, are we just so kind of mesmerized by the idea that these issues are in the media all the time? Why are we allowing this, what I call the both sides delusion, of the media, where we have our basic, not just our basic rights, but our basic humanity brought up for debate still? Why are we still not past that? We don't see white supremacists brought on television to talk about racial issues. We don't see Holocaust deniers brought on to talk about issues regarding Jewish people. Why do we still have people who have been certified as hate group leaders who put out defamation that has been shown to be completely reckless and wrong, and information that just is so damaging, and claims that gay men molest children and all of this? And I'm talking about the Family Research Council and the American Family Association and other groups. Why are they brought on television? Can understand having serious debate and serious discussion about issues. So I'm not talking about censorship, but I am talking about getting rid of this both sides delusion when it comes to just who we are. Why is it everybody, every time something is discussed, they have to bring one of these people on? And then why don't they say, this is Tony Perkins from the Family Research Council with his put out hateful defamation that says that gay men molest children and this and that, and has been labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Then maybe it would be a little balanced. Or this is Peter Sprigg, who says that sodomy laws should be brought back and LGBT people should be put in jail. They don't do that. They bring these people on as legitimate spokespeople, and it again shows me that we're far from victory, and that it's far from over, and that we really need to take on the media as well. I also moved into male team sports, and really there are so many other issues, and I'm sure some of you will ask about them as well, that I looked at and analyzed in the book. But I sort of moved toward the end to looking at male team sports, because I kind of see that as really kind of the factory of homophobia in our culture that goes right back to high school and, creates that sort of the hatred against women, the hatred against transgender people, the hatred against gay people. I mean, it's all kind of, connected. If you're not playing well, the coach says you're being a girl or a sissy or a pansy. And what is that really all about? And then all of that is taken into professional team sports, where we still see this, horrific bigotry that is not dealt with. We had a coach on the Minnesota Vikings say that gays should be put on an island and nuked, and he was given like a 3-game suspension, 2 if he went to sensitivity training. We've had people who've worked for the most horrific bigots given, rewards as, director of player development on the New York Giants, David Tyree. The very job that a gay player, the very position, the very person a gay player would have to turn to if that player were to come out. And I wanted to look at male team sports because I believe that obviously because there is such a place in culture, no matter what you think about sports, that male team sports are put, and these people are held up as heroes, and that, you know, we need to have the same sort of reaction as there would be to any other expression of bigotry against any other group. I also kind of look at it, and why I built to it at the end, as sort of the way we're going to dismantle this bigotry in the culture moving forward. I talk a lot in the book about revolutionizing education and what California is really beginning, and how we need to do this in every state, teaching about the history of LGBT people, teaching about the individuals within the history of this country who were LGBT figures, who were people who contributed an enormous amount, to break down that homophobia, that transphobia that kids might learn at home and in the culture. They would get it at school, and this is what they're doing in California, and the textbooks are being, finally, it's taken several years to get the textbooks updated, but they're being rolled out this year, and they'll teach about Harvey Milk, and they'll teach about the Mattachine Society, and they'll teach about the Holocaust, and not forget the part that, gay people were also put to death. And it's kind of like just working it into the curriculum, not as a separate sort of thing, but as part of history. And that needs to be done in the sports programs as well. And that we need to kind of redefine masculinity as not being in opposition to, because that's kind of how it is defined for young men. And then, what we see today is men feeling they're under attack. They're under attack from women. They're under attack from now the gays. They're, but if we actually raised children without defining masculinity as in opposition to homosexuality or gender, women, et cetera, we might have a different culture. We might see things change as we move on, and that kind of brings us to the roots of what our movement was about, which was changing gender norms and sexual liberation, period. Because rights are one thing, and we've just now gotten just a little bit of rights, because we still need many rights, but we really want to change the culture. So it sort of really shows you that, wow, it's not over. And people say, well, that's very utopian. And I say, well, who would have thought we'd have come this far? There's no reason why we can't do all of the rest as well. And I end the book with an epilogue, in fact, that sort of is a call to action and steps people can take in their own lives together moving forward to get so many more of the rights that we need federally and in the states, to kind of break out of the victory blindness, to break from the covering demand and stop covering, to teach self-empowerment and self-defense. I talk a lot about that in dealing with bullying and the terrible, if there's anything that shows that we're nowhere near victory, the terrible reports that continue of LGBT teens taking their lives. Self-empowerment, self-defense, stop asking for so little. Not only is it psychologically kind of bad, but it's strategically, politically bad. And what I'm talking about is we've asked for 20 years for this Employment Non-Discrimination Act, this narrow employment bill with religious exemptions, right? And Hobby Lobby, I think, scared the daylights out of everybody, and they realized how dangerous the religious exemption was. Now we saw with that Indiana, and I'm sure we're going to talk about all of that, how dangerous these religious exemptions are. But why have we been only asking for an employment bill with religious exemptions, exemptions for the people who would discriminate? There's a kind of a whole mindset that, of activism that is sort of like, you have to just ask for a little bit at a time, and you gotta slip in the back door in a way and do things quietly. And I think what we've seen is what I show in the book is the wins we've had were because we didn't do that, because the grassroots led and there was a backlash. Yes, people decided they needed to get married in Hawaii. They were couples who needed rights. They were living in rural Hawaii. They you know, were not people of means. And yes, there was a backlash. And the, you know, Washington, the leaders, the Beltway leaders were like, no, this is, what are they doing? Marriage, but this is going to create a backlash. We are trying to pass this ENDA. They've been trying to pass this ENDA for 25 years now, right? And they can't get a pass. And marriage now looks like it'll happen because people decided they needed to do it, but also because we asked for a lot. It was outlandish, and wow, it worked. Instead of asking for a little, because you look like, do you really feel that you don't deserve that much? So I think we need to kind of reorient our whole strategy, and I talk a lot about that in the epilogue as well, and drop this kind of, you know, asking for little pieces. Ask for it all, and, you know, fight it out and see what you get. And all of that, all of these things, the covering demand, the victory narrative, you know, taking on the media's both side delusion, all of it adds up to a whole new attitude and getting beyond tolerance, which I think is what we certainly need to be thinking of, instead of this idea of, you know, just being sort of allowed to exist, which is tolerance in and of itself. So thank you all very much, and I'd love to hear your questions and your thoughts as well. Thank you. We're going to take questions, and I want to just ask people to make sure to ask the question into the mic so that we can make sure that it's able to be heard, and I'll make sure that I answer it back in the mic.
So we're facing an election, and if Hillary Clinton wins, certainly by the time 8 years has passed, Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be gone. And I don't see any way, if a Democrat is elected, that any Democrat will get any court appointments to the Supreme Court, the appeals courts, or even the district courts, through any Senate that has at least 40 Republicans. So that gives rise to the question, I don't know how you would answer it, is that if we get marriage rights in June for everyone, and she goes and Stephen Breyer goes, as well as Kennedy and Scalia, because they're all 80-ish, if the court tilts and we wind up with a pile of Republicans, whether you think they would dare take it away after it's been won?
I think you point to the precariousness of the Supreme Court and rights for everyone and every group, including us. And in this victory blindness, we somehow think that, you know, I don't know. Some people kind of think like we're special. Somebody's decided we're special. Well, one man on the Supreme Court likes us who happens not to really like women and doesn't really like African-Americans, okay? Justice Kennedy. If we have a 5-4 ruling as we had in, you know, the DOMA case, that's a far cry from Loving versus Virginia, which was a 9-0 ruling banning interracial marriage. So we're in a very different world, and people just don't get it. They think, oh, we're going to be so accepted. If not for Justice Kennedy having some, what, you know, and there's been some discussion, he had a gay law clerk or whatever, liking gays, we would not be anywhere near where we are right now. And I'm just not sure everybody really understands that. They think, again, this inevitability thing. America has decided that, you know, they like us. African Americans, looking at the gutting of the Voting Rights Act in the same year that DOMA was struck down, did anyone think that would happen? So when you ask me the question, would they ever roll back a marriage? I mean, I don't know if anybody ever thought they would ever roll back the Voting Rights Act, but I'm less concerned with them rolling back marriage. I guess I feel I don't see that necessarily happening. But what I do see, and what we have seen the Supreme Court do with women as well as with racial minorities, is just, you know, narrow more and more of other rights. So,
all the abortion,
right, all of the abortion decisions, but even pay equity, so many other issues, rape culture that women are still facing. You know, we've seen these movements grow that are a backlash to it, and then we see it playing out on the court as well. And we have no idea, really, and this is all tea leaves, you know, reading, how the court is going to rule in June in terms of what legal theory they will make this decision on if they do rule for marriage equality. But if it's the lowest possible standard, it will certainly leave all these other questions open about the Bakers and the you know, the religious freedom for these people who own businesses and whatnot. And all of that will be still open. And when you talked about Hillary Clinton, you know, becoming president, if that does happen, and it very well could be that one of these Republicans becomes president, because none of us knows anything. Just getting a bill passed, I mean, you mentioned getting people on the court. Just getting a federal civil rights bill passed is going to be an enormous slog. We've had the biggest surge of Republican governors and Republican legislatures. And, I, you know, when I say Republican, people say, well, that doesn't necessarily mean anti-gay, but it does, because that's how it's played out. We've had the biggest surge since 1920. So these 29 states that don't have rights, you know, a few of them may change, and I hope that happens here. But it's not going to happen in Alabama. It's not going to happen in Mississippi. It's not going to happen in Oklahoma and elsewhere. And a federal bill, you know, with the House in control of the Republicans, which looks like it's going to be for a long time, I just don't see that. I think we're in for a very long slog, and we're sort of, we've got to snap out of this thing where, you know, Justice Kennedy happened to like us, and we suddenly think we've won everything. So I'm glad you pointed to the court, because I think it's an important thing to think about.
When Jackie Robinson was coming up, first African-American baseball player, the announcer for the team, I forget his name, he was going to quit his job, didn't want to do it, didn't agree with management's decision, but then he decided it was his responsibility to announce the game and not necessarily make judgment on anyone's decision. And I know you talked about how, I guess, the harbored feelings can be more dangerous than the more external ones. So how do you kind of cope with that? And like the gentleman over there talked about the auto mechanic who wouldn't service a car going to a gay wedding.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up in the context of sports and Jackie Robinson, because when Michael Sam came out, it obviously was history in the making when we had the first football player who openly gay drafted to the NFL. And obviously there was a lot of support, but there were a lot of people who, you know, there were some players, some sportscasters who made homophobic comments, and, you know, we saw all of that. So that still played out. But nonetheless, there was support. The president, Michelle Obama, made great comments. You know, the NFL itself put out great comments. And then Michael Sam did something that I thought was great. He didn't cover. I was talking about covering. He could have, as a, you know, and when I talk about covering, you know, many people in the LGBT community can't cover. They are either, you know, men who are more gender nonconforming or effeminate or feminine or butch women, or, you know, transgender people who people can easily figure out maybe they're transgender. But a lot of people who can cover, you know, decided that maybe they shouldn't. And Michael Sam was that. He was a conventionally masculine guy who could have just sort of, you know, faded in. But he didn't. He decided to kiss his boyfriend on national television, and the whole world went crazy. You know, I went on CNN the next day, and Carol Costello, who has grilled anti-gay homophobes and, you know, certainly has done a great job, and I often have a good conversation with her, she was saying, well how is he going to handle this now? I mean, didn't that kiss go too far? And he has to now go in the locker room with these people. And what is he going to do? Should he talk to the team about the kiss? I'm like, no. Why should he talk to them about the kiss? But what it, I think, highlighted was that there's this covering going on and how detrimental it is to us, and that the only way we're going to really get at this deep-seated homophobia is to desensitize the hell out of people to things like same-sex intimacy. And, you know, yes, there will be explosions of, you know, reaction, but again, you can't get in the back door. You have to have the reaction. You have to have that, you know, visibility that creates the outrage. So I think the way that we do it is the way we have been doing it. Being visible, being out there, being open, not, you know, some people said, let's reach out to these people, or let's, you know, maybe we should, try to understand why these people don't want to serve gays, or why do we even care, or who wants to go to a gay baker, or this and that. And I just think that's already, a defeatist strategy. I think we need to be as out there, as visible, as confrontational as possible. It may lose you some people in the short term, but I think it's sort of in the long term, particularly in our culture. Our culture is such a rough and tumble culture. Nothing gets done without everybody throwing a lot of crap at the wall. So I think we need to do that and not think that we're going to get it by being nice.
I'm appreciative of your strategy, but I'm not sure that we have named the real issue. And I have two different ideas. I think they may be related. You said you were talking about gay men and so forth, and then you said rather casually, I have no reason to believe it's any different for lesbians or bisexuals. And when we do that, when we kind of say that casually, lump them all together, I'm wondering if we aren't missing a gendered explanation of what we're really against. So I will bring up my second point, mm-hmm. which is yesterday I was told by a Jewish woman how there's been such a great increase in anti-Semitism on college campuses, which I was not aware of as a good Protestant. But I have been, as a woman, very painfully aware of all the laws that are going down against women, particularly even the woman who in Indiana is going to prison for 44 years for a miscarriage. So I'm wondering if we've named what it is that's pushing against all of these groups. I mean, the Black Lives Matter and so forth, and the woman in Pasadena who has been arrested. I mean, it's happening across the board in so many ways that I'm wondering if the strategy that you're suggesting needs to be more coalition built, or
I totally agree with.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how do you name then what it is we are against?
Yeah.
That would include other people to make the coalition stronger. That's my question.
Yeah. It's something that I think we had and we lost at a certain point. And it's hard to know, was it that movements diverged, different issues affected people? But certainly in the beginning of the backlash against abortion rights, many gay men were involved in a lot of those protests and taking on the bigots, seeing the connection that it's about your body and what you do with your body, whether it's sexual activity or, you know, a pregnancy. And I think that's really been lost. I think that we've kind of all diverged. And what I try to do in the book is really string together, particularly looking at the women's movement and the apathy that grew from within, with this whole idea of being post-feminist and, we've gotten the Equal Pay Act passed, we got Roe v. Wade, and that's that, and falling for the, you know, feminazi attacks, like, oh, see, they think we're so harsh. Rush Limbaugh calls us feminazis. We need to be nice, right? I try to point to all of that and say, let's not let that happen to us. But yes, how can we bridge all of these back together and kind of see the connections? And that's where I, you know, when I talk about sports and how so much of this is connected with masculinity and even, you know, as race sort of is, you know, defined with regard to masculinity as well. I mean, there's a masculinity that is defined as a white male masculinity, right? That demeans everybody. So that's one area where I think we can kind of come together. And I get back to this issue of revolutionizing education and teaching across all of these various groups that intersect with each other.
When you told the story of the kiss in Chelsea, the guy said it was disgusting. My gut reaction was, and I'm sure it wasn't just I feeling that, that could well have been a gay guy, because the way things are now, a straight wouldn't be caught dead saying that in Chelsea almost. And it's like, I mean, one knows that there are many like levels to the issue of how that subject is perceived and handled. Now, my question for you is, what's your gut feeling, or maybe not just gut feeling, but how excited or unexcited are you about Hillary Clinton becoming our almost presumed next president?
How excited am I about Hillary Clinton becoming our almost presumed next president? When I look at Hillary Clinton and I see all of the criticisms of Hillary Clinton, consummate insider, very slick, name your criticism. And then I look at all these Republicans. I take every one of those things that are critical of, you know, the critical items about Hillary Clinton. We're in a very dangerous time, I think, with where the Republican Party is, who has the Republican Party in its grips. And it's not just the Tea Party and the Christian right, but it's the big corporations that have now managed to just, you know, completely get this enormous power through Citizens United. It's a very dangerous time. And I would like to see a progressive president, and I would like to see somebody who's more progressive than Hillary Clinton. But if the reality is that we have to make Hillary Clinton be the best Hillary Clinton she could possibly be, then I'm fine with that too. And I think that we can, and I guess that brings me to back to the strategy again of Washington Beltway gay groups. They're already sucking up to Hillary Clinton. And Equality California already endorsed Hillary Clinton before she was running, before she said she was running for president. And I just don't understand it, because Hillary Clinton, she was very late on gay marriage. She still kind of hasn't really, I mean, I know she put it out through a spokesperson in the last couple of weeks that she, okay, thinks the Supreme Court should do this, but that's not really championing our rights. And marriage is done. We need somebody who's going to say, we need a full and comprehensive civil rights bill, and we need our groups to be holding her feet to the fire. And I think every group needs to hold her feet to the fire on all of the issues that are really important. And the argument needs to be made that it's, one, about energizing the base, because, you know, the victory narrative, one thing it does do is make people apathetic even when it comes to voting, right? So it would be very smart of her to scare the daylights out of the gay community and get them energized and get scare the daylights out of the entire progressive coalition. It is a strategy that energizes the base, but also, and I can't for the life of me figure out why, you know, Hillary Clinton's strategists and gay groups aren't making the case. Maybe they are. It's a great weapon now to use against the Republicans. They're the ones who are split on these issues. They're the ones who are divided. Look at this insane stuff that's been playing out just in the last few days with, would you go to a gay wedding? And no, I wouldn't go to the wedding. I'd go to the reception. I went to a reception, but not the service, not the actual wedding. Yes, I'd go to a wedding, but I go to my friends who divorced. I go to their remarriages, Marco Rubio said. And it's just, they're the ones who are totally split on the issue. And you could be the champion who is very consistent. And so I feel like, let's pressure Hillary Clinton. Let's also hope that there really is a real primary that forces these issues to be debated. Hillary Clinton has not really put out positions about a lot of things. They've been kind of vague. Let's make that happen. And on all the issues, but for us, on LGBT issues.
I know that the Republicans are hideous. But when I think of Hillary Clinton, I think of when she was in Moscow a few years ago, next to Luzhkov, the mayor of Moscow. And as far as I know, it's never come out since, that she never challenged him on the persecution that Russians were enduring at the time.
As the Secretary of State.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember.
So my point is, I think that the LGBT movement, certainly parts of it, made a crucial mistake. And frankly, I think it was led by Joe Salmanese and Human Rights Campaign.
Yes.
And that's, we did something, or they did something, that the civil rights movement did not do. Martin Luther King never put his demand for rights in the back pocket of any particular political party. And that's essentially what has occurred.
Not only any party, but HRC was actually backing Hillary Clinton. And Barack Obama won the primary.
Exactly.
So it wasn't even the party. They were actually backing the wrong person early on.
And I think the other element is that we've gone through, it kind of makes me shiver to think how long, this phase, I hope it ends, that it's a very mainstream phase. That were just like everybody else. When you look at the so-called victories, they were military and marriage according heteronormative marriage. So instead of taking, as this woman suggested, a hard-nosed, multi-pronged, bringing in issues of the thousands of abandoned youth that never made the radar of HRC, let alone what was happening to LGBT people overseas, also not making that radar. But I think what we need, despite the Republicans, because it isn't just the Republicans, we live in a very conservative country. And until we take a really determined, hard-nosed, multi-pronged, coalition-based endeavor, we're really not going to go anywhere.
And
in fact,
true.
We're going to suffer the threat of having all of our achievements, real and so-called, erased, along with achievements that other people have made in relation to women's rights and African-American rights and et cetera.
I agree. HRC is already saying Hillary Clinton. Fred Sains of HRC said Hillary Clinton. The New York Times asked, why do gays really gravitate toward Hillary Clinton? I don't even know where they decided that was true. And then he said, because we understand the trials she's been through and we love her like we love our moms. And I'm like, we don't want Hillary Clinton to be our mom, right? We want, if she's a politician, we want specific things. I have been very critical of the Human Rights Campaign. Those of you who listen to my show, those of you who read my work, know that I've seen the Human Rights Campaign as having done a lot of things that I think are really destructive and not speaking on behalf of the grassroots of this country, not tapped into the grassroots. And it makes us less effective than, I think, other movements where they do understand that they need the grassroots. They need to have those people behind them. And ultimately, anything we've gotten has been because people finally got off their butts and, pushed past HRC, even on marriage, even on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because even on those issues they thought that, that was too much to ask Obama, and we couldn't, we had to have a march on Washington. We had to have people chaining themselves to the White House fence. We had to have people interrupting President Obama's speeches. So I think this larger question is, why do we allow HRC to run everything, and how do we sustain that grassroots action not allow them to speak for ourselves? I think it's a larger question about organizing people to have a counterforce to that, because it is about money and lobbying, and it only then, supports a specific agenda of the gay movement. So that's our task, and I think that's the hard one. It's not just them. It's the rest of us that haven't done something.
First of all, thank you for this book and also for your 20-plus years of purposeful advocacy. It's meant a lot to me, and I know to millions of readers.
Thank you.
I think any gay person in this audience has probably had a straight person say to them, boy, it's so much better now to be a gay person, isn't it? And I've never formulated a great answer that's kind of a yes, but, and short of giving them your book, how do you answer that when someone straight says, isn't it great now? Isn't it much better?
Mm-hmm. I tell people, I throw out a bunch of questions to people, do you really think that gay people are represented in a really accurate way? Is that what you really think that we look like? Do you really think that it's okay for people to be thrown out of a restaurant? And here's where the media has done a terrible job, because they gloss over all of this. Whenever I do ask those questions to straight people, they are kind of bewildered because they can't believe that that happens. Most straight people believe that there are protections, federal protections. They think that we're protected in the Civil Rights Act. And then the second thing they do is when you tell them that, because I'll always ask that, don't you think gays should be in the Civil Rights Act? And they say, well, they are, aren't they? No. When you tell them that, they then say, and people are, people can be thrown out of their job or the restaurant, they say, but that doesn't really happen, does it? And it's really amazing to me. And then I tell them the stories of the people who've been, the couple who were told in Texas, thank you for coming, and I hope you had a great dinner, but please don't come back. We don't serve fags here, right? And then they're shocked. They're absolutely shocked. Now, that's one story. And we know that that's like, there have been so many stories like that. And those are only the stories that we've heard about, right? And I also then ask them, how would you feel if you, navigating through your whole life are constantly aware that a certain move, a certain look, a certain outfit, a certain way you say something could suddenly peg you, because it's, and suddenly you're facing hostility or just judgment, but sometimes violence, right? I think it's something straight people never think about. And I think it's something we don't think about a lot because we're so used to it. But I think we all know it, it's the daily slog of things that, we just kind of slough off. But when you add them all up, it's a lifetime's worth of snubs and nasty looks and comments like that's disgusting or obviously with some people violent attacks. But even if it doesn't get to that, it's that. And I asked them, how would you feel if you had to go through life knowing that you're going to be judged or faced with hostility at every turn, and how you're often practicing saying something so you don't sound gay, right? I just don't think it's what straight people really think about at all, and that's what I try to tell them.
It seems that religious organizations are major obstacles to LGBT rights. The good news to me is that the younger generation seems to be more progressive towards LGBT rights and fairly indifferent to religion. So which do you think we'll see first, an openly gay homosexual president or a atheist president?
It's an interesting one. Barney Frank says, stay in the atheist closet if you're a politician. Come out if you're gay, but stay in the atheist closet. I want to address the issue of younger people and this whole thing, younger people, all the polls support gay rights, and this is the future, and that's why it's going to go away, because I think that's another dangerous victory narrative that's out there. When I go to CPAC, Conservative Political Action Conference, and Values Voters Summit, but particularly CPAC, because Values Voters Summit is already a sort of religious conservatives, and Conservative Political Action Conference is more, kind of all the conservatives, the religious, the business people, they only have three constituencies, right? The Tea Party, fiscal conservatives, and the religious right. I'll ask young people because most of the people at CPAC are, the average age is like 29. Do you support gay marriage? Do you support gay rights? And it's the same thing all this polling shows. And these stories that are always, New York Times, they always do a story from CPAC and they interview these people. And they only ask that question. They never, in the polls and in the articles, they never ask the second question, which is, would you vote for a candidate who opposes gay marriage or gay rights or thinks gay shouldn't be served? And by the way, the young conservatives on the bakery thing are in a very bad place. They, especially libertarians, they think everybody should be able to discriminate against everybody, that the government shouldn't be involved in anything. And if you get them to really be honest, they'll tell you that you should be able to turn away people of color, that the business should be able to do whatever it wants. So they never ask that second question, though. And I ask it, and they say, well, I mean, that's an important issue, but it's about priorities. And, I would put my priorities first. I like taxes to be cut. I want immigration to be controlled. I want, and then it becomes the conservative litmus test. So, I go back to with the young people, when you put your faith in the young people, ask them about, and they have been asking them for many years about racial issues, and they'll say, oh, no, I don't think that people should be discriminating. Oh, no, I don't think this is wrong. Or ask them even about abortion, and they'll say, they're pro-choice, but they still vote for anti-choice Republicans. They voted for George Bush, right? They voted for Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, you know, when they looked at the youth vote in 2012, President Obama won the overall vote. But when you broke it down by race, Romney overwhelmingly won among white voters who were Republican. Those young people, when asked about choice, they support a woman's right to choose. Romney didn't. They don't believe there should be a federal marriage amendment. Romney did, right? You can go down the list of things. So I get very, you know, leery of this, that the you know, the young people are going to necessarily change it. The people who control the machine have ways of getting people, you know, what we're seeing is the rhetoric lowered, right? And that's, you know, a way of, because what could scare them if it's, you know, too blatant. So they dog whistle now. They don't say blatant racist stuff, although they still do sometimes. They, you know, try to dog whistle on women's issues, and they now dog whistle on gay issues. Now it's religious liberty. And that's trying to get at that implicit bias, right? And not so explicit. So that's what I think we have to watch for moving forward, and also see that they're creating young stars. So the Tony Perkinses and, you know, the Brian Fishers and all of these old white Christian, you know, right leaders. Phyllis Schlafly, I interviewed at CPAC. She's 90, right? And she's still in the Eagle form, and she said to me, "We're not going away," right? They may die, but now they've got Ryan T. Anderson at the Heritage Foundation, you know, very young, you know, highly educated, never says anything wrong, you know, anything sort of, you know, I don't mean wrong, but, you know, in terms of terminology that's too blatantly anti-gay, but he's just as bigoted as the rest of them. There's a woman named Robin Fretwell Wilson, and she's helping all of these states. She helped Utah craft their law. She worked with the Mormons there. She's, you know, in that Utah law, that gay rights law, has all these religious exemptions and doesn't cover public accommodation. She worked with them. She's a legal advocate. And she uses the term LGBT and talks about the LGBT movement and this and that. But she's as anti-gay as, you know, Tony Perkins. So they're learning our language. They're bringing in younger people. Eric Erickson from Red State, Dana Loesch, who's a Tea Party radio host. That's kind of the next generation of these people. You know, I think they'll continue to try to bring in young people and just kind of lower the tone but not change the position. Right, and getting to the NRA, one thing the NRA does is, unlike HRC, they have a huge connection to their grassroots. And they, you know, yes, they do the lobbying and they have the money, but they don't piss off their grassroots. They keep a connection because they know at the end of the day, it's the phone calls and the pressure on those senators and those people organizing out in the states who are really going to put the pressure on, that put the fear into these legislators. We have to emulate them in that way as well. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.